7, here today given by Dr. Naftali Lowenthal.
Unfortunately.
Rochelbus
in when her crusader comes back, it will continue.
Her elder Zeta is here.
Right. Wishing a good year to everyone. And we're now holding just after Parshas Bereishis yesterday, and it's Shabbos Parshas Noach. So I'd like to take a theme which links both Parshas. The first thing is that in Bereishis, obviously, we have Bria's Olam, 5779 years ago, and with all the details about how in 6 days HaKadosh Baruch Hu created everything step by step, and all the whole Bria and all the creatures which are in the Bria, culminating in Adam HaRishon and Chava. And the confrontation that Am Yisrael are having in this country and in several countries in the world, unfortunately also in Eretz Yisrael, with people who believe in what's called the theory of evolution, with a very strong emunah, and as a result, that is the modern form. It used to be that we were faced with, let's say, Christianity in the Middle Ages, and they would attack us, baptism or death.
I think it's called creationism.
No, that's the opposite. Creationism is what we believe, that Hashem created the world. And so we have this contrary force. So I thought I would quote one or two things that the Lubavitch Rebbe wrote concerning evolution in a number of letters. So there was one letter he wrote to someone called Mr. Yishai Meir Halevi, who lived in Paris in 1953. So this is a letter that this gentleman, who was a Frum Yid, and he wrote to the Rebbe asking, what is the perspective of Torah on the theory of evolution? So the Rebbe responds, first of all, he says, what kind of evolution do you mean? We now talk about Darwin's evolution. But there was also a theory of Lamarck, which was another kind of concept, Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, who lived before Darwin, also had a kind of theory of evolution, a different way, but also the idea that one Bria changes into another, one creature changes into another. So the Rebbe says straight off, the perspective of the Torah is clear. For one of the reasons for the mitzvah to rest on the seventh day every week is because in 6 days Hashem created heaven and earth. And on the seventh day, Shabbos. So the whole idea of Shabbos is based on the concept of 6 days of the week and then the seventh day. And the Rebbe says this is to be understood as 6 literal days. Not tkufos, not epochs, not periods of time. And then the Rebbe mentions a sefer which talks about the idea that the 6 days are not literally days of 24 hours, but are epochs of time. Now this sefer you have here in this place, Medrash, probably. It's in the Perush on the Mishnayos, Tiferes Yisrael. Right? Rabbi Yisrael Lifshitz, who passed away in 1860, just at the time Darwin published his book, 1859. That's right. And Reb Yisrael Lipschitz, he gave a drush. It's called Drush Or HaChaim, and it's printed in the big set of Tiferes Yisrael, roughly in the middle. It's just after Seder Nezikin comes this Drush or HaChai. There he suggests that when it says 6 days, it means 6 epochs. And speaking about fossils, people knew at that time about fossils, different layers of fossils. So he said, he suggested, these are remnants of less perfect world, the idea that Hashem boina olamos machrivan. So he linked that to the concept of fossils, so therefore they're the destroyed worlds that preceded this one, so as it were, the world was built up in layers.
Fossils are, of course, nonsense.
Okay, we'll come to that in a second.
He was quite definite about it. He said what had to be said.
Okay.
I mean, it says, Elef Shonim Be'enecha Kiyom Eshmo. Doesn't that enter into the equation?
Well, one can add that in. However, there are Yireim and Shleimim who follow what the Drushah HaChaim says of the Tiferes Yisrael. However, the Rebbe's perspective is that when it says 6 days, it's literally 6 days. And he quotes... Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer and Midrash Rabba Bereishis and Sanhedrin Lamed Ches Amud Beis, which talk about what happened in the different hours of creation. That there were on a particular day there was this thing happening, that thing happening. Now, so it's controversial because we are faced with a problem which has to be dealt with. So now comes the question. See, the Rebbe analyzes this theory in terms of what's called a scientific theory. So, for example, you have various things that you see, and then you have different phenomena, different things that you see. The theory puts together the things that you see, and it presents a way of understanding how it fits together. Let me give you a simple example of things we see. You take a glass of water, you put in a cube of sugar. The water is cold, and you wait to see, maybe you stir it 3 times, you see if the sugar dissolves. When it's cold water, not much of the sugar dissolves. If you have a glass of hot water, you put in a cube of sugar, it'll start dissolving. Give it 1 or 2 stirs, it dissolves away. Now, why does it dissolve quicker when it's hot?
Molecules moving faster.
Right, so there you have a theory of molecules. That there are molecules of water, and heat means the molecules are moving more quickly. Right. Okay, so that will be your theory with the glass of water. Now, you can try out the theory. You can do an experiment with a glass of something else, and not sugar, but something else. You can try it out, and you can see examples and see if your theory works.
Empirical science.
When you come to the concept of evolution, the idea that one organism changes into another is something that has not been seen at all. All that is seen, and here the Rebbe was referring to a concept which today there are words for it, and at that point they didn't have the words, the difference between microevolution and macroevolution. Micro, you see, Darwin made a whole tzimmus out of the fact that he went to certain islands in his voyage in the Beagle, and he saw a certain kind of finch on the island, little birds, and he saw the beaks of the birds on this side of the island but this way, and the bird the other side of the island, they had slightly different beaks. So he made a whole thing. The beaks are changing shape in order for them to get food in a better way in their respective habitat. That's right. Adapting to the environment. Right. And in fact, we can see this today. There are moths, for example. The moths in Manchester, I think, the example. Because Manchester is so sooty and smoky, there are a kind of moth, which you could have white moths or you could have dark moths. So in Manchester, the dark moth is more prominent because it's camouflaged, because it's on the sooty building, and it's less likely to be picked out by a bird swooping down and having a nice juicy moth for breakfast, hopefully. Not before davening, but swooping down.
Licking your lipstick.
But all that is what's called microevolution, one creature developing different features, different colour, this, that. But it's not one creature changing into another. That's macroevolution. So the difference between, there was recently a talk among Mechanchim, speaking about the current issues that are happening, and a learned Rav suggested that, look, microevolution, we can teach about microevolution. Macroevolution is the issue. But the process of microevolution is itself something which is observable. And the Rebbe makes the same point. The Rebbe says that there are minor changes within species that you can see, and that's fair enough, that's fine. And, you know, exactly why it happens, is it, do you look at it this way, that way, is it genetic, is it mutation, is it adaptive? There are all kinds of different ways of understanding how it's taking place. But the idea that one creature should change into another, that's absolutely not seen, that's not been observed. And the Rebbe mentioned the point that we are now in a position where in a laboratory we can generate thousands and thousands of generations of certain, like, microscopic creatures or other creatures. We haven't been able to make one creature change into another. It still doesn't happen. They can make fruit flies which have an extra pair of wings by meddling around with genetically, but they can't change a fly into a worm. It doesn't happen. So now that raises the question in general. Then we have the question of fossils, which David mentioned. So the Indian of fossils, I mean, I'm not quite sure how Victor Miller puts it. What the Rebbe doesn't machavek the concept of fossils. He says, first of all, fossils might have been formed in a much closer time scale than they suggested. You know, if you think about the Mabul and things like that, so that might have been the source of fossilization of things which exist, and so therefore it fits. That brings us into Parshas Noach. So you imagine the Mabul. The Rebbe doesn't speak about this, but I'm suggesting the Mabul presents the idea of a tremendous water pressure, a pressure of water around the whole world, so there we can imagine a fossilization process taking place. That's, in other words, that the skeleton of the creature is replaced by stone. That's the concept of fossilization.
An expedition of processes that occur over a passage of time due to extreme circumstances which are not presumed in the theories that give them time tags.
Absolutely. But then there is a concept that was written about in a book written around the same time as Darwin's Origin of the Species by a man called Philip Goss. The Rebbe doesn't refer to the name of the person or the book, but he refers to the idea.
Was he English?
He was English, yes. G-O-S-S-E. So Goss wrote a book called... just one second, what's it called? Omphalos, An Attempt to Untie the Geological Knot, 1857. He knew Darwin, he had heard Darwin lecture, and he was concerned to link the concept of what people were seeing, what scientists were seeing, paleontologists, they were talking about fossils, they discovered fossils, and so how do you fit fossils in to Voracious? So the word omphalos is a Greek word, and it means belly button, navel. Now the navel is the part of a person which was connected to the mother, to the placenta in the mother. So he said, did Adam Arishan have a navel? did he have an omphalos?
Umbilical cord.
And why not?
He wasn't born.
Well, that's right.
He was created.
He was created. But nonetheless, Yesh Lomer, Hashem created him with a belly button.
No, because the belly button is only what is left after it's the umbilical cord is set, severed and knotted. So it wouldn't have been. There's no problem there. I don't know why he makes that into a problem.
Oh, no, he's not making it into a problem. He's making it into a solution. We have the idea of the trees in Gan Eden. Okay, so let's walk around in Gan Eden together. If you don't mind, we're going to cut down one of the trees. We're allowed to eat the fruit from all the other trees. Never mind the Eitz Hadas and the Eitz HaChayim. We'll take some other innocent tree, an apple tree, and we start cutting it. Cut it down. How many rings are on the stump? So let's say there's 20 rings. You count them. Does that mean it's 20 years old? No, we know it's only 2 days old.
No, they were created, so they wouldn't have had that rings because that was an instantaneous happening. Yeah. But afterwards, when the Almighty that made the blessing, the Eitz Pri Yosef Pri Liminoi, then the process of generation was created, and from then the number of rings would indicate the number of years that it grew.
Well, that's one way of understanding it. Adam and Chava themselves, were they created as one-day-old babies? No.
They were created, that's a Zohona Keva Boro, and then it would. So they wouldn't have the signs of normal development. Well, Cain as well were born instantaneously. So at some stage, after the curse, after the sin, then Be'etzer Teirut were born him. From then, the protracted generative development timescale came into being.
Okay, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I'd like to suggest another way of looking at it. That the way that Hashem created the world was that the world had built in the look of age preceding it.
Oh.
Now, Philip Goss has a word for this. He calls it prochronic. Prochronic, it's towards time, that there was a process leading towards time. But in fact, it was there already. That's how Hashem created the world. Hashem created the world with Adam and Chava's grown up, Adam and Chava looking as if they had been born, that is the sign of the navel, the trees having rings, the rocks looking as if, according to modern geological ideas, this rock is so old, that rock is a different age, and things like that.
I don't think obviously he was still tied up with secular thinking, this man.
Okay.
He wasn't basing himself on the text.
But he's looking at the existence around, and he's giving an explanation for fossils, which the Rebbe does not cite his book, but he suggests in his letter, Hashem could create a world which has fossils 100 feet down, 200 feet down, whatever it is, for Hashem's own purpose, that we don't know. And so that concept of a world which is created as a whole world, together with stars, sun, moon and stars. Nowadays people talk about the idea that the light from a distant star takes many years to come here.
Yes, yes.
But Hashem could create the world in such a way that that light is already reaching the world. So it's as if the star began 1,000 years earlier or whatever, and the light has taken 1,000 light years to come here, and nonetheless it's there, visible at that moment. So that's questions about Bereshis, but then we move into Parshas Noach. Now in Parshas Noach, there's a very interesting pasuk. It says, "Bishnas sheish moishonin l'chayin Noach," in the 600th year of the life of Noach, b'chodesh hasheni, etc., "Nivku kol mayonis tohoim rabo," all the fountains of the great deep were opened, v'arubois hashamayim niftochu, and the windows of heaven were opened. Right? So you've got the tahoim from below and the windows of heaven from above. The trap of the pasuk is water, rain was pouring from above, the springs were flooding out from below, and that's how you have the model. The Zohar HaKadosh says, which is quoted in a Sicha of the Rebbe, in Chelek Tesvav of Likutei Sichas, it says in the Zohar Azoi, Uvashisme Shnin Lishisa, in the 600th year of the 6th. Now, Yiftechun, Tare de Chochma Sola'ela, Yispatchun, sorry, there will be opened the gates of upper wisdom, Umabuye de Chochma Solasato, and the fountains of lower wisdom. Wisdom, the istakan alma, and the world will be perfected or prepared la'alo b'shviyah, to go into the 7th. Now, what does it mean, the 6th and the 7th? The 6th millennium. So, in the 600th year of the 6th millennium, and there will happen something which will be the opening of the upper wisdom and the opening of the lower wisdom, and this will be a preparation for the time of Mashiach leading to the 7th millennium.
How many millennium we're now in?
Now, we are,
we're in the 5th.
Yes.
And we're not, we're in the 6th now.
We're in the 6th. We're in the 6th millennium. Yeah. And what is it? We're in the 6th millennium. 5,000. We're in the year 5779, so that is in the 6th millennium. Now, what year is... Right, okay, so what year is the year 600 of the 6th millennium? That means 5,600.
How about 70 is it?
5,600, yeah. In English dates, it's 1840. Now, there's a pirush on the Zohar Kodesh, which explains that what it means, the upper wisdom and the lower wisdom, the upper wisdom means Pnimius HaTorah, the Soidus HaTorah, and what it means, lower wisdom, means the wisdom of the nations of the world, Chochmas, science. When we look at the year 1840, first of all, we see in terms of the Chochmah of Pnimius HaTorah, the Ksovim of the Mekubalim during the 18th century were all in manuscript. Then, beginning, things, various things, but together with the rise of the Hasidic movement, Svarim began to be published. There was the Siddur HaRizal in various editions. There was different Sha'arim of Reb Chaim Vital and various other Svarim. There were, and when we come to 1840, the time around 1840, in 1837, Torah R, a beautiful collection of Hasidus by Reb Shneur Zalman, was printed on Bereshis and Shemois. And then there was a Malshinus, and so they couldn't print the second volume immediately, but 1848, they printed the second volume, Likutei Torah, which is on the rest of the Chumash and on Shir HaShirim, and many other Svarim of Hasidus, Bnei Yisoschar, various other things, deep, beautiful Svarim of Pnimius HaTorah were being printed. And so there you have what you can say is the Arubas of Shemaim Niftochu, the windows of Shemaim opened up. At the same time, 1840, the most remarkable developments in scientific terms were taking place. This was a key period of development of scientific thought, which led to the present. So the Rebbe asked the question, why we can understand that the revelation of Pnimius HaTorah leads to the coming of Mashiach. Why should scientific things have anything to do with it? Why should there be any mention of science? So this is, he suggests a number of different ways. One is that through the existence of certain scientific and technological developments, it helps a person have emunah. For example, we live now in a town where there's CCTV everywhere. CCTV is watching people, what they do in the street, including here. And the Rebbe suggests,
everyone's smart.
This strongly helps. I was once on holiday in Wales, in the summer holiday, and I met a man, my wife and I, we went for a walk, we met this man. What is he? He's a policeman. What's his job? His job is to monitor what happens in the streets in London. I said, but London's... He said, yeah, I sit here in Wales, in the mountains, in a little village, looking at a screen, and he can see what's happening in Oxford Street. So, and if anything problematic happens, immediately he's on the phone. And so the idea that there's an eye in Roya, that there's an eye that can see everything we're doing, it just becomes much more, and the Ois and Shamas just becomes much more tangible because of this aspect of scientific technology, that there's that people are able to see and hear and record. You spoke before about, you know, is in the memory, and it's the idea that Hashem is aware all the time. It's just made a little bit more tangible. Obviously, you could think about Hashem being aware of you without having this technological thing, but it's a step more obvious. A second way, says the Rebbe, is that technology can be used for the communication of Torah, as we're doing at this second, phoning it through, people are able to listen at different places. This is and then it's recorded, they can listen later on.
It's ancillary.
Yes, that's right. It's a sad. It's a help to Torah learning. We have many Bate Midrash today, I don't know if you have it here, that have Oitzah HaChochma, about 75,000 Sfarim that a person can have instant access to a huge number of Sfarim in a little thing that you can hold in your hand. Baruch Hashem, 75,000 Sfarim. And other things of this kind. The idea of communicating Torah and of making access to Torah, the Shilas and Tshuvas project with thousands of Shilas and Tshuvas, so Rav has an unusual issue. He can look up and discover a tshuva that was written 12 years ago in Italy on a certain subject, and it will help. The third way is the idea that science itself reveals the glory of Hashem. And that itself, you see, you have in Yeshaya, Se'umu roi meinechem ru'u mi bora'ein. Lift up your eyes and see. Se'umu roi meinechem. It's a she and mem eye, like Shema Yisrael. Lift up your eyes and see the heavens, or see anything. Look down a microscope. Look at crystals under a microscope. The more one sees the actual details of existence as they are disclosed layer after layer and level after level by scientists working, examining this, examining that, it's just incredible, the Niflos HaBoira. It's absolutely incredible. I remember one of my daughters was learning biology in school, in Lubavitch school, so I was sitting with her, helping her with her homework. I thought, what a fantastic, amazing thing. Discussing some aspect of the body, that you look at the way in which the eye works, which is such a fascinating way. Incidentally, Darwin could not work out how an eye could have arisen through evolution. He said this is a real challenge to its theory. That's
the atom as well, the complexity of an atom. I mean, the force of released in an atomic explosion because the atom isn't so well bonded together, shows the energy and matter together, the dibur, the heaven of the Almighty, if you could compare it to that, produces a substance that itself is constructed of immeasurable forces.
That's an absolutely amazing idea. You see, the Rambam says that the fact that the world exists, it's not just that Hashem created the world. Hashem's force is needed all the time in order for the world to continue to exist.
He willed it into existence.
Yeah.
But Hashem's will has to continue every second, keeping the world in existence.
Sure.
Yes. And it says the same thing in Tanya in Shah Yechav Emunah, quoting from the Baal Shem Tov, one of the great presentations of the Baal Shem Tov. is that the world is the energy going into the world is a continuous energy. It's like the electricity coming to these lights, that you know the light is shining because the electricity is going in. If the electricity would be switched off, like pressing the switch or a power cut or something like that, the light will go off. So the world is here because there is a stream of divine energy keeping it in existence. And so all the time, there is this divine quality. And the more you look at the details of the world, the more you can see this fascinating quality. Now, the people who unfortunately are trying to promote evolution, it is their faith. There's a very prominent man called Richard Dawkins. Stephen Hawking.
Oh, Hawking,
I beg your pardon. He's there.
Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, no, but
that was
great. But he, so he wrote in a book, he's trying to say, he's trying to say, you know, how can we work out how the eye came about through the evolutionary process of natural selection and so on and so on. So he said, you know, you have to be very ingenious, he says. And if you can't be ingenious, so too bad for ingenuity. You just have emunah. He didn't put the last words, but that's what it is. It's a faith system. He's saying, you know, if it's lamayla min haseichel, it'll have to be lamayla min haseichel. So we're not talking about Yiddishkeit, emunah, versus rationality. We're talking about two rival faiths. Now, we've always been faced with rival faiths. There's this kind of faith, that kind of faith. Baruch Hashem, we are machzik, our faith, our emunah. But the fact that science itself reveals the glory of Hashem, and in fact, science is changing in all kinds of ways. All right, to be honest, the scientists who are at the frontier of exploring evolution, even those who believe totally in it, can see that there are major problems in it. But that does not filter down to the school classroom and the school textbook. No, the school textbook puts everything in reductionist ways, simplistic ways, that this is what happened, whereas scientists say they had a meeting. They had a meeting of large numbers of scientists discussing whether microevolution, that means like the beaks of the birds changing or the color of the moth, does microevolution lead to macroevolution? And so this was an article published in a scientific magazine about their discussion. They could not see how it leads one to the other. So they still believe in it, but they can't see how one leads to the other. In fact, there's a story of a Chinese paleontologist. A paleontologist is a person who studies fossils. So this Chinese paleontologist came to a conference in America, and he gave a talk, and he criticized Darwin. So an American colleague says to him, "Professor so-and-so, You criticize Darwin, you know, coming from China, I would have thought, you know, you come from such a strict society. I'm surprised you can criticize Darwin." He says, "Listen, here in my society, we're not allowed to criticize the government, but we can criticize Darwin. In your society, in America, you are allowed to criticize the government, but you can't criticize Darwin." So the Rebbe speaks about the way that it used to be thought that the 93 or however many elements were separate, that these were the separate substances which formed the world: hydrogen, oxygen, gold, silver, whatever they are, all these different, yes, they have nice little letter names in chemical language, Na is sodium and so on. So it used to be thought these are 93 disparate elements which go to make the world. But now they realize that all these elements are made of atoms, molecules and atoms, and the atoms are made of protons, electrons, neutrons, that's right. It's a small number of, relatively small number of forces which in fact go to make the whole of existence.
They're colossal forces, they're colossal, immeasurable. You can't split an atom of iron, but you can't split uranium, whatever number it is, because it's unstable, and look what happens when you do release it. Mm-hmm. The energy is phenomenal.
Right. So. But later developments in quantum mechanics all leads to the idea of a unified universe. That the universe is a unity, it's not disparate, and the unity of the universe is really an expression of the Achdus,
to the evidence of creation,
of the Achdus of Hashem, and the realization that Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, and that ultimate reality is what is revealed through, as spoken about in the Zohar Kodesh, commenting on our Parshas Noach, which will lead us, Bezras Hashem, to the coming of Mashiach Tzidkenu, when everyone will be able to see this. The world will be filled with knowledge of Hashem, like the waters covering the sea. Yeah.